Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I got a random email from a reader. He gets the reading list email, which I send out every month, just my favorite book recommendations. You can sign up there at ryanholiday.net. But this guy just sent me a note. He said, I wanted to recommend a book that I think you'd like by Paul Woodruff, a classics professor at UT Austin. He said, I'd heard you on the Dr. Drew podcast, and you mentioned your struggles in researching for your upcoming book about justice. So sometimes people ask me in the reading list, how do you find these books? What do you recommend? Well, I have a very fortunate advantage, which is people like Daniel just shoot me these unexpected notes. And I looked it up, and it turns out that Professor Paul Woodruff is not just based in Austin, but is an absolutely fascinating character. Professor Woodruff has been a philosopher, writer, and translator at the University of Texas at Austin since 1973. This is a guy who has dedicated his life to these topics. It's just absolutely fascinating to me. He was an officer in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. He's written a number of books about ancient philosophy. He's translated a number of works of ancient philosophy. And as it happens, as he told me in this interview, the very first book of philosophy he ever read was The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. We had a great conversation. And it's just wonderful to be randomly, serendipitously exposed to such a wise and thoughtful person. This is one of my favorite conversations I think I've ever had on the podcast. And I think you're going to see why. Professor Woodruff's book, The Ajax Dilemma, Justice, Fairness, and Rewards, that uses an ancient story from the Odyssey to talk about this problem we have today, how to keep things, how to make society work, how to find fairness in an unfair world, how to get to justice in an unjust world, and then where does the role of compassion come in? He said, I wanted to understand justice in such a way that it's fully compatible with compassion. If justice is going to help us get along, it has to affect our feelings. And if justice is a quality of character, it must be about feelings, because that's where character is, in the feelings that help us do well or poorly. In that last analysis, I will argue, justice and compassion come down to the same thing, to a sort of human wisdom. So this is, as you can imagine, exactly the kind of thing I needed to read and wanted to read as I'm researching this book that I'm doing now, the third in my Four Virtues series, the first being about courage, which I also talked to Professor Woodruff about, the next being about discipline, which I talked to Professor Woodruff about, and then the third being justice, and then the fourth being wisdom. So all these virtues are inextricably intertwined with each other. I think you're really going to like this episode. Enjoy. And I'm hoping to have Professor Woodruff out to the bookshop to do another episode in person one of these days. So stay tuned for that as well. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so your you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. I'm doing a series now on the cardinal virtues, and I'm on the justice book now. Justice is it's a difficult thing to define, isn't it? In a sentence, or even a few sentences.
Yes, justice is extremely hard to define, and the Greek word we translate justice and injustice; those two words could also be translated right and wrong,
right?
Because they have a broader range than our word justice. They refer to pretty much all of the ethical considerations that apply to our dealings with other people.
Yeah, it is tricky, because I think when people hear justice, they have kind of an almost instantaneous aversion towards it, because it has this sort of modern political or legal context. But obviously it's a much broader concept than that.
Yeah, because the ancient idea about justice is that justice is a necessary condition for human survival. That is, in order to have a community that can function without tearing itself apart through anger and violence, we need to have not just justice, but we need to believe that we have justice, and that we actually can get along without violence.
Yeah, aren't a lot of the plays of Aeschylus and Euripides sort of about what happens when people pursue grudges and their own individual sort of pursuit of justice without, you know, a system, when they give themselves over to the Furies, if you will?
Yes, I think that's right, especially the most famous set of plays is Aeschylus' Orestia, mm-hmm. Which is about a family conflict, really. Mom killed dad, and now what are the children supposed to think about this? Because on the one hand, they're loyal to their father, and the other hand, they're bound to their mother. And all three playwrights wrote about this problem, but Aeschylus has it resolved in a formal trial. The idea that you can have a public proceeding that's organized by the community that resolves a violent dispute was really important to the ancient Greeks. And actually, it goes back to Homer.
It is interesting to think that these things were invented by someone. Like there was a time that these things did not exist, and that these are in some ways the greatest achievements of a society.
Well, I think they always did. I think every functioning human society, going way back, we find it, I think, in Stone Age communities as well, has some way of settling quarrels so the community can go on. And we see references to this, as I said, in the very earliest European literature, in Homer and Hesiod. But you're right, there was an invention, and this happens around 508 BC in Athens. The politician Cleisthenes invents the concept of the people's courts, which were pretty much unique to Athens. But the people's courts consisted of boards, really, or committees of citizens who functioned as judges in these cases. Elsewhere in Greece, there were individual judges or very small committees, but Athens had this idea that the ordinary people could function as judges.
It's a beautiful notion. You know, it's funny. I just looked across my desk. I'm going through the note cards on the book that I'm doing now, just some last minute like things that I wanted to plug into the book. And I wrote this one down from Euripides' Electra, which sort of encapsulates, I think, what we're talking about. There's a difference between justice and the right thing, I guess. The line is, she now has her just deserts, but you have not acted justly.
Yes. There's a curious ambiguity about this language. The word dike, which we often translate justice, can mean payback. Mm. And in Euripides, it often does. You know, I'll pay you back for this. I'll give you dike. You gave me violence, I'll give you violence. That's dike. There's another word with the same root, dikaiozune, which is the word that Plato uses for justice. And while dike can mean payback, dikaiozune can't. And they're cognate. They're based on the same root.
Yeah, you say early on in the book, and I've seen other this in other classic texts, so it's sort of a timeless. But you sort of try to define justice as this idea of giving a person their due. What does that mean exactly?
Well, that
is that the golden rule, or is it more in the notion of payback?
I have to say quite a bit about this. I can't give a short answer.
But we've got time. Let's do it.
Yeah. I think what I'm saying there is that the community has to believe that its members are getting what is due to them, or the community may dissolve or divide in a violent way. And I won't say anything about, I shouldn't say very much about current events, but it does appear that a lot of people think that they are not getting what is due to them.
Sure.
That what is due to them is going instead to people of color or people.
That people
with,
are skipping the line, or that something that someone else is getting is coming out of their hide or their pockets.
Right. And so they respond with violence, or with threats of violence. And of course that's destructive.
Sure.
Of the community and society and of government and of the state. And so it's really important that people believe that they are getting what is due to them on the whole. And how do you, the political and social question is how you build this sense. What I'm doing in my work, in this book especially, and in other things I've written about justice, I've written quite a bit about justice, is following Plato's line on this. And Plato, I think, emphasizes the importance of to the survival of the community, of the acceptance by the community of whatever kind of justice the community has adopted. And so I don't want to apply some abstract theory of what is due to people. I think the community has to work that out, and there are different ways of doing it. I suppose one of the reasons why today there's this violent conflict in Iran is that there's a strong difference of opinion about what is due to women who don't wear, don't cover themselves up in the,
sure,
in the required way. This difference of opinion is so strong that they are hanging people publicly who take a view that differs from that of the government. This is a sign of a breakdown in it's conceivable, and no doubt in history it was true, that there was a consensus that women should be punished for not dressing according to a certain code. This has changed in many Muslim countries, but the authorities may still be clinging to the older idea. And that, in the case of Iran, is leading to violence.
Sure.
Which is very disturbing. But it shows, again, it illustrates the importance of this Platonic idea that a community needs to build a consensus around what is due to people.
Yeah, it's interesting because I guess like what is due to people, it encompasses all the different conceptions or iterations of justice. So, you know, what is due to people is a question that applies to distributing the spoils of something, of society, of a business, of, you know, opportunities, which obviously you talk a lot about in the book. And then also what is due encompasses the more payback sense of justice, which is one committed a crime, one did something wrong, what is due to you in, you know, return or in punishment for that fact?
Yes. And of course, there are different theories of punishment. The Platonic view, which is the one I'm trying to promote here, is that a just punishment is one that makes the miscreant more just. So
sure,
it's educational and reformative. Whereas there is this other view, the retributivist view, that a just punishment is an eye for an eye, a payback.
Yeah.
But I think that approach is on the whole destructive of community, and what we need is to take more seriously the idea that justice, wherever we apply it, makes the people to whom we apply it more just rather than less just. And this is the opposite of what we see in our own prison system.
Sure.
People are made worse by our imprisonment.
And then I guess there's also an interesting component of justice there, which is what does the inflicting of the punishment do to the person inflicting it, right? So you mentioned the U.S. public prison system. You know, what does that do to us, the national character? I think one of the most interesting essays in the sort of justice canon is Seneca's essay on clemency, right? His idea that providing mercy, you know, not deliberately not punishing, letting one get away with something, but not engaging in retribution as being one of the higher forms of justice. And yeah, you think about Iran and literally hanging someone to death for a protest about what women should be allowed to wear. You know, it's not just that that punishment is cruel and damaging to the common good of, you know, and the people who are the victims of that punishment, but the perpetrators are also staining and undermining and implicating themselves in the process there.
I think that's right. They're damaging themselves all up and down the hierarchy, from the tyrant down to the hangman.
Yes,
because all of them are, well, in a way, they're all of them in violating what I think is the most fundamental Stoic precept, which is not to work against what is natural. And there, this might bring us to talk about anger.
Yes.
Anger at some level, at a low level, is natural to all of us. It occurs in every culture. And it would be a violation of this precept to try to suppress anger totally. You're going to feel it when you feel that wrong has been done to you. But the Stoic, I think, would try to avoid feeling it as a passion, and would insist and the Stoics are Platonists too, right? Yeah. So I'm not that far from the Stoics. The Stoic would insist that reason not be overcome by anger, because that would be to give way to passion. And at least as I understand it, I don't know if I told you, but the very first book of philosophy I read when I was 13 was Marcus Aurelius.
And Meditations.
I've loved that book ever since.
Yeah, it's an interesting book if you think for what you've ended up writing about, which is, you know, he talks about justice constantly. He was a person who was regularly in a position where he had to dispense justice, give people their due. And it seems like in Meditations, he had a bit of an anger problem that he was working on or working through in the pages of that book, you know, talking about not losing your temper, not being angry, not making decisions out of anger, because that's not good for himself or for other people.
Right. It's a wonderful book.
It's one of the most surreal and strange books ever written, I think, because, you know, it has no idea of the reader in mind.
Yes. Well, he is his own reader, I guess.
Yes.
And we see how a man with real challenges, who is committed to Stoicism, tries to face those challenges in line with Stoicism.
Well, speaking of the Stoics and Plato, one of my favorite lines in Meditations, which I've talked about many times on podcasts, is where he says, "Don't go around expecting Plato's Republic." He's saying that he doesn't live in Plato's Republic; he lives in Rome in the second century.
Right. Oh, yes, that's a very important sentence. Yeah. Plato himself is not waiting for the Republic. It's a thought experiment.
Yes.
And it's not even an ideal. If you read carefully the way the Kallipolis is introduced, that's often said to be the ideal city for Plato, but it really isn't. Kallipolis, I would translate, the snazzy city. It's a city in which people have appetites that they would better off not have, appetites that lead to warfare and require having a military class. But the first city, the one he talks about earlier, doesn't require a military class, because the people's appetites are more reasonable. than they are in the snazzy city. So the Kallipolis, which is a very important model for Plato in many ways, it's a thought experiment, but it doesn't represent an ideal. It represents perhaps an ideal way of dealing with a community that has non-ideal desires and passions.
What do you think struck you about, as you try to go back to you reading Marcus Aurelius for the first time, and then I'm sure you've returned to it since then, what strikes you most about Marcus, or what has stayed with you the most?
What I find most helpful from Marcus Aurelius, and I frequently apply it in my own life, is a way of reducing or eliminating angry feelings. I'll give you a slightly humorous example.
Yeah.
I love bird watching, and I have a bird feeder. And for a while, I found myself getting angry at the squirrels that would try to steal bird seed from the feeder.
Yeah.
And I know many bird lovers who are just fuming with anger at squirrels. And I thought about this, and I said to myself, you know, I'm actually very closely related to squirrels. They're mammals.
Sure.
They do what they need to get food. Everything they're doing is entirely natural to them. And as Marcus Aurelius says, it's inappropriate to be angry at anyone for doing what's natural for them to do. And
yes,
of course, it's natural for the squirrels to do this. So instead of being angry at them, I should just order a little more birdseed, which I did. And actually, I like watching squirrels, too. They're a lot of fun to watch. And I've decided I try to feel the same way about politicians I disagree with. They're just doing, they're like the squirrels. They do what's natural to them. This is very much Marcus Aurelius' way
yes.
of dealing with people he finds objectionable. Yeah, it's their nature. And it's wrong for me to get fussy about people doing what comes naturally to them. Their selfishness, their ignorance. This is unfortunately natural to them. I shouldn't be angry at it.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next-to-listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
You had an operative sentence there that struck me right out of Meditations, where Marcus says, you know, I recognize in the wrongdoer a nature similar to my own. So I love that you said, hey, I'm related to the squirrels. There's a little bit of squirrel in me too. Yeah. I'm not going to judge them, take it personally. So it's like seeking to find the connection and similarity and empathy as opposed to the difference, the distinction, the otherness.
Oh, you put that beautifully. Yes, that is a lovely thing, recognizing a common human nature with the person that you find obnoxious. I too can be selfish. I too can be ignorant. I'm just ignorant of different things. And so I need to be... I shouldn't be ashamed of my first angry impulse, but I do think I should be ashamed if I let it govern my actions and start shooting the squirrels with a pellet gun. I'm doing the right thing by buying more birdseed. And yes, you can apply the same thing, I think, in politics and try to be more open to other people's actions and attitudes.
It's also interesting in Meditations, you know, Marcus talks about zooming out. You know, he says, talks about taking Plato's view, and you zoom out far enough. And, you know, he's saying that, you know, me and these armies fighting over this scrap of territory or these resources, it's not really that different than the squirrels, you know, fighting over the bird seed, or the birds fighting with the squirrels, or the squirrels fighting with the birds, or the squirrels fighting with each other, that, you know, you zoom out big enough and these things that feel very important to us start to look a little small and silly.
Yes. I love thinking of it that way.
Well, let me ask you a question. So, you know, Marcus Aurelius is, you know, the decision maker. He's the leader. He's having to make, you know, decisions pertaining to justice in the real world in an imperfect in an imperfect environment. You know, it's obviously one thing to talk about justice as a philosopher, but when you were an officer in the army, the shoe was on that foot. You were not thinking about these ideas in the abstract. You were having to make real decisions, sometimes, you know, decisions with the potential for life and death implications. What did that teach you about how you now conceive of this idea of justice?
You know, I can't stop thinking about my experience in the combat zone in Vietnam and the feelings I had and the actions that I took. It's in war, moral injury is almost unavoidable because there are so many conflicts that you enter, and you have to decide: am I going to? I think I'm under attack. Am I going to shoot back, or am I going to wait to make sure there are no civilians there?
Sure.
These are hard decisions to make. What I remember is that hard as those decisions were, anger, in my case, didn't have a whole lot to do with them. You know, we're just trying to survive and do what needs to be done. I I think I probably ought to have been more angry at our command because they were making such stupid decisions
sure.
that were destructive of the Vietnamese people. I was an advisor, and so I became close to some Vietnamese people, and I felt, I mean, this sounds like a cliche, to some extent I felt their pain and discomfort, and I was upset that I couldn't do anything that would change the way we were mistreating people.
Mm.
This, you know, my, I've just this week seen copies of my new book, which is called Living Toward Virtue, which is largely informed by that experience and my Socratic concern for finding ways of living that don't expose us to moral injury. And one way to keep yourself from being exposed to moral injury is not to go to war.
Sure.
There still are plenty of opportunities for moral injury outside of warfare.
Well, I've been thinking about this recently, and I've asked a handful of admirals and generals that I've been lucky enough to interview on this podcast, but you might be in a unique position to answer. I'm obviously fascinated by Admiral James Stockdale, who, you know, a unique sort of philosophical yes. warrior. He's introduced to Epictetus. Epictetus is what guides him, you know, through his later years in the service, guides him through his time as a POW. But he has this interesting, you know, set of experiences in that, you know, he was in the Gulf of Tonkin the night of the so-called incident. And, you know, he has this famous quote. He goes, "Nothing happened. I literally led the initial strike of a war I knew was under false pretenses." And I, you know, I remain fascinated by this sort of heroic philosophical figure who was clearly put in an impossible and extremely, you know, you talk about moral injury, that is a situation endemic to moral injury. But how do you think about that? What does that quote bring up in your view?
Well, to my mind, one of the principal responsibilities of leadership is to try to protect people from that kind of moral injury.
Yeah.
What happened in the Gulf of Tonkin, there was an incident, mm-hmm. right? Had it been correctly understood, it would not have led to war.
Yes.
But it was initially misreported to Lyndon Johnson, from what I understand. And then, and he communicated this false view to the world. And then when he got correct information, he suppressed it. He didn't want to go back on what he'd said earlier. This is my understanding from people who've been involved with the LBJ Library. My good friend, Betty Sue Flowers, was director of it for some time. And Johnson was distracted very much by his quest for civil rights. He wasn't really paying attention to the Gulf of Tonkin. But he made a terrible decision when he didn't walk back the story he told about the Gulf of Tonkin. And we pay for that. I'll give you a piece of my own story, if it's okay.
Please. This is fascinating.
One of my responsibilities in Vietnam was to write reports about the success, and it had to be a success, apparently, of the Phung Wong or Phoenix program, which was designed to detain or intern civilians who were supporting the communists.
Yeah.
And this is not an unreasonable thing to do. After all, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus in order to detain people who were supporting the Confederacy in Maryland and some other states. It's essential, I think, in any civil war that you have some kind of detention program, because you're dealing not only with soldiers, but also with civilians. So it's not in itself a terrible thing. But as I filed these reports, I began to see a pattern that I interpreted as the detention of innocent people who may have been accused of supporting the VC because they'd annoyed somebody, or because at night the VC would come into the village, and if you didn't do something for them, your family might be severely punished. And that doesn't make you the sort of person who should be detained. The people we were trying to detain were kind of a communist shadow government for the villages and hamlets. And what I began to realize is we weren't getting those people at all. And by the way, I was right. You know, at the end of the war, it became apparent. We learned that those people that we were trying to detain and claiming to have detained were all living quite safely in caves on a certain mountain, which is now a kind of public park. They have a statue of Mickey Mouse there. Children are taken around the caves and shown where these shadow governments were surviving in the caves. And it's almost an amusement park.
And the people you were detaining, you were probably making more sympathetic to the communists by the nature of how they were treated.
And not only that, but it was deeply unjust. And the camps where they were being detained, which were being run by contractors, were violent and miserable places. Anyway, I reported what I found, that this program was not working. I wrote up a report. I sent it up through channels, which is the only way to send up a report in the Army. Mm-hmm. And it was stopped by the colonel in command of my advisory unit, who said, I can't send this forward. This program has had glowing success under my predecessors. You're telling me that in my watch, it's gone downhill. I can't report that. So it didn't go forward, and I couldn't figure out a way to send it forward. I think maybe there was a way, but I didn't know what it was. And also, I have to confess, I was afraid to anger my commander in a serious way because of what he might do to me. You know, that it's not unusual for an angry commander to send a young officer to his death. And I didn't want that.
Wow.
So for one reason or another, I let that report lie.
And I suspect that's probably, part of the explanation in Stockdale's case, which is he saw this thing, he had this sort of suspicion of this thing. It probably hardened into a clarity later, obviously when it was confirmed by subsequent events. But, I think he was a commander in the Navy at that point. So he had some power, but it's not like he could call Lyndon Johnson himself and say, hey man, nothing happened. You've been given the wrong news. It's tricky when you have seen something, exactly how one should go about saying something.
Yes, and a commander is a fairly low rank.
Yeah.
The point I'm leading towards here is These are examples of terrible leadership. Mm-hmm. Right. The White House should have reached out to Stockman and used his story in a positive way. And the colonel should have recognized that I had some information and intelligence that he should do something, that he had an obligation to do something about, but he didn't. I think a very important responsibility of leadership is to pay attention to what people lower in the ranks know.
Yeah.
And we see failures of that that lead to moral injury to those lower ranking people.
Well, this is where justice and wisdom are interrelated or intersectional, if you will, because it's hard to do the right thing when you don't know what's actually happening, and also deliberately not learning what's happening is a way to insulate oneself from having to face or deal with an injustice that one is complicit in or responsible for, potentially in a position to do something about. You don't want to know.
Yeah, you put that very eloquently. Let me give you another kind of example. This is an example that I took from a novel, and I wrote about it in a draft of my book and showed it to a philosopher friend who said, "That's exactly what happened to my mother." So the story is about a social worker who faces this difficulty. She's responsible for observing the care, the state of children, two children who are being brought up in a rather ramshackle trailer by parents who have no money and no education and really don't know how to raise children. So the social worker requires them to go to take a course on how to raise children and in other ways tries to help the parents. The mother of these kids has a brother who is often indigent and who, when he can't stay anywhere else, stays in the ramshackle trailer with the family and abuses the children. So the social worker tells the parents, you have to kick this guy out. If you let him back in the trailer and he abuses the kids again, I will have to take the kids away. Well, of course, these parents have no way of keeping, they can't even lock the door on this trailer, right? They have no way of keeping the uncle out. And so the children are abused again, and she has to take them away and put them in foster care, which is terrible for the kids.
Sure.
Right? They're much better off with their parents. And so she feels, if she'd left the kids with the parents, that would have been wrong. If she takes the kids away from the parents, that's wrong. And she feels terribly morally injured. And there's, she could cope with this by closing her mind to what she knows about foster parenting.
Right.
But in this case, she doesn't. I'll give you another case, which is also true. The Marines, when they first went to Vietnam, went under the command of General Krulak, who was predicted to be the commandant of the Marine Corps.
I just read a biography of Krulak, actually.
He's a very interesting man.
Did you know he was Jewish and he spent his whole life denying that he was because he was worried about anti-Semitism in the Marine Corps?
Yes, I do know that. In other ways, he was a very brave man.
Yeah.
As you know, he realized right away that in Vietnam, the way to cope with a counterinsurgency was to protect the civilian population so they could develop social and democratic
institutions,
protocols. So he stationed Marine units in the villages with local troops to protect the population. General Westmoreland, who was the stupidest general in American history, I think, found out about this and said, "What are you guys all cowards staying in the villages? Get out there and kill some Viet Cong." He mistakenly thought that this was a war of attrition. Mm. And so the Marines had to leave the villages and go out into the jungle where they took enormous casualties and did no damage to the other side that was serious. Mm. Krulak went outside the chain of command, as you know, went to the Oval Office and talked to LBJ about this and said, you're just wasting Marine lives for no good purpose.
Yeah.
And LBJ, who was probably about twice the size of Krulak, literally threw him out of the Oval Office and denied him his promotion to commandant. Again, a failure of leadership.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I think of that photo of LBJ and Krulak where you have photographic evidence of what speaking truth to power looks like, and power does not like to hear truth.
Yes, and that's bad leadership. Power should want to hear you.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, there's much to admire in LBJ, but there's also much to deplore. And it's tragic, I think. Krulak, I think, kept his honor by speaking truth to power.
Yes. Yes, he did. He is a fascinating character.
You know, his son did become commandant.
Yes.
Of the Marine Corps, and was a very very successful one.
Yes, I read I interviewed Robert Corum on the podcast, who wrote the biography of Krulak. It's called Brute, and it was fascinating and interesting. And Krulak, I'm not sure I would have wanted Krulak to be my father. I guess that was one of the takeaways that I took from the book.
I think you're probably right, but he turned out very well.
It seems
did good things for the Marines.
So to go to this idea of Krulak speaking to LBJ, etc., you talking about, you know, you have this information, you know how your supervisor or your superior is going to respond to it. That's one of the themes you talk about in the book, is the relationship between justice and courage, you know, knowing the right thing and then doing the right thing when there's going to be consequences. You use the example of a senator, you know, taking a vote that may or may not cost them re-election.
Yeah. And I can imagine I would hope that senator, if he really has done wrong in order to be reelected,
yeah,
would be aware of the moral injury he's done himself.
Yes.
And of course, I think right now we're seeing a number of politicians take steps that I'm sure they'll regret later on.
Isn't it interesting, like in the case of a politician or a general, how often someone might be brave under fire? They might not be intimidated by physical risk, but the other kinds of risks manage to stop that person.
I think Krulak is rather an interesting case because I think by the time he'd reached the highest rank he reached, he could have said, and by the way, I'm Jewish, and,
yes,
and look what a good Marine I've been. Mm-hmm. But he didn't have whatever it took to do that.
Well, I think he probably internalized, as I guess they say, he'd internalized a kind of a self-hatred or a self-loathing that oppressed groups occasionally do or often do. He internalized perhaps that there was something wrong with him, that there was something to be ashamed by in his Jewishness, which of course is That's, not correct. But
this is true of many oppressed peoples, that they internalize the attitudes of their oppressors. Yes. Very sad.
It is. It is. Yeah, it's tragic. What's the difference, or what's the relationality between courage, or sorry, justice and fairness? Are they the same thing?
Thank you for asking that. Most people think they are the same, and the philosopher John Rawls is famous for arguing that justice really just is fairness.
Mm.
I think this is a mistake, and the ancient Greek thinkers clearly do not identify justice and fairness, because justice is fundamentally whatever it takes to keep a community from tearing itself apart through anger, the passion of anger, whereas fairness is abstract. And would, you know, it would translate something like isotes or equality. Fairness is treating like cases alike. And that's a good thing on the whole. But what makes like cases alike is rather complicated. And in fact, in real life, every human being is a little different, and every human mistake or crime, again, is a little different. And applying universal rules to these cases can be just, but isn't always, because people are so different and have different values and different motivations. So Aristotle introduces this notion of epieikeia, which I translate appropriateness, and insists that, I mean, his concept is that there's justice, and then there are these two kinds of justice. There's the kind that is equivalent to fairness, and then there's epieikeia. Fairness would be applying the law equally to everyone, and epieikeia, appropriateness, is trying to make your actions appropriate to the circumstances in the case. And he understands it as doing what the original lawmaker would have you do if the original lawmaker had thought of this particular case. So it does seem to me that justice involves looking at particular features of cases and taking them into account, where fairness involves thinking of everything under the under a universal principle.
And probably your experiences as a military officer, you know, it gives you a sense of how, you know, fairness is this rule that you apply in any and all situations or in alike situations. It probably was an interesting lesson in how unalike or unique every situation is, and how insufficient a lot rules or orders or you know, standards can be.
Yes, I learned most about this from my experience as department chairman or chair, where I discovered that if a colleague were unhappy with his salary or his or her treatment in some other way, explaining and proving to this colleague that in fact the treatment was entirely fair, it was what everybody else was getting, that just made them more angry than ever.
Yes, and children teach you the same lesson.
Yes, I know. I've had them, and grandchildren too. So I realized that fairness simply is not enough to diffuse anger. Mm. And a good leader finds a way to diffuse anger to keep the community together. And I lost one wonderful colleague because I simply was unable to convince him that he'd been treated justly when all we had done is treat him fairly.
So, well, you know, it's interesting. I think it was Plutarch. Plutarch said something like, kindness is bigger than justice, because kindness extends to animals and the environment and things which are beyond justice. And so maybe there's fairness, if we're thinking about sort of a hierarchy or concentric circles or whatever, there's fairness, then beyond fairness is justice, and then, you know, clemency, kindness, mercy, etc., are in the sphere beyond or past even justice.
I believe that one of the most important virtues is the capacity for compassion, which mm-hmm. you just mentioned. And I write about this in almost every book I've written, because the more I think about it, the more important I think compassion is. And I think compassion is a responsibility for leadership. Groups tend to be ruthless to outsiders, mm-hmm. but the leader of a group can insist on compassion.
Yes.
And this, by the way, this theme of leadership and compassion shows up in a lot of Sophocles' plays. It's one reason I love Sophocles so much.
It doesn't show up much in the governance of the state of Texas. I imagine you would agree.
No, I'm afraid not. But there's an old puzzle which goes way back in Christian ethical thinking. How could it be that God is the most compassionate and the most just possible being? Because if God is maximally just and maximally compassionate, then it would seem that compassion and justice have to be compatible. Mm. If justice is fairness, then it's not compatible with compassion, because fairness can't be compassionate. It has to treat every case exactly the same way.
Because fairness is blind.
So this is the main reason, really, why I want to argue for a separation between fairness and justice. I think justice has to be compassionate.
I think that's right. And to go to where we sort of began, if it's just, but it is without compassion, you're simply giving everyone their due, which means, you know, hanging people for this crime or locking them up for a life sentence for that crime. Eventually, you know, that creates moral injury to the person giving the so-called justice or fairness. To be without compassion, you know, ultimately eats away at, you know, the person who is lacking the compassion, I would feel.
It eats away at your humanity and your sense of being part of the same species, if you will, with these other people for whom you lack compassion. I firmly believe that when you do violence to other people, you are doing some kind of violence to yourself.
I think that's the most beautiful and probably consistent theme in meditations. And I think it surprises people because, you know, they see Marcus as this sort of unfeeling robot, as the embodiment of what stoic means. But I think what's most beautiful is how often he talks about the common good. He talks about forgiveness. He talks about putting himself in you know, other people's shoes. He talks about, you know, seeing the common nature between people. I think one of the more underrated themes of meditations is precisely the compassion and connection that you're talking about.
I agree.
Well, Professor, this was a real honor for me, and I loved your book. And will you send me the new one when it comes out? I would very much love to read it.
Well, it just came out this week.
Oh, congratulations.
It's
okay, well,
Living Toward Virtue.
All right, well, I'll get it, and maybe we can do this again.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
I live out in Bastrop, so not far from you. Maybe we can do it in person.
Well, I'm so glad to meet you. You're someone who's read widely and thought deeply about these subjects that I care about. So I'm delighted to know you.
Well, I'm honored to hear that. Thank you very much.
Hey, it's Ryan. Thank you for listening to the Daily Stoic podcast. I just wanted to say we so appreciate it. We love serving you. It's amazing to us that over 30 million people have downloaded these episodes in the couple years we've been doing it. It's an honor. Please spread the word, tell people about it. And this isn't to sell anything. I just wanted to say thank you. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.